Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. Hey, my name is John.
Hey, I'm JP, and today we will be going through chapter 4. There's 5 tips, and chapter 4 is called Pragmatic Paranoia.
Where it works out great for this chapter is like it's kind of a, even though the tips are kind of thick, very bulbous tips we're walking through, there's fewer of them. So we can kind of knock out this chapter in one episode, which is a little bit different. Lately, we've been kind of parsing them up because either A, we talk too much, or B, there's just a lot to get through. And I think it's a combination of both.
We just have so many opinions on each of these little snippets, little nuggets of advice that we just want to share.
Yeah. So this whole chapter is a lot about, like, the title is Pragmatic Paranoia. And it's about, like, kind of not trusting yourself and not trusting users of your application in a good and productive way. So I'm going to blow through the tips real quick. Let me read through the overview. So we're starting at tip 30, and we're going all the way through tip 35 today. So first tip, you can't write perfect software. Design with contracts. Crash early. If it can't happen, use assertions to ensure that it won't. Use exceptions for exceptional problems. And the last tip is finish what you start. So you want to open us up with our first tip, JP?
Yeah, so tip 30 is you can't write perfect software. And it's funny because I feel like most of these little tidbits are meant to keep developers sort of in, like, their ego in check, because I feel like oftentimes, you know, a lot of these tips are based around the fact that it's like, hey, you don't write perfect software. Just because you write something a million times doesn't mean that there's an edge case you didn't account for. So this is just sort of that again. It's, you know, don't think that you are like God's gift to programming sort of a thing. And perfect software doesn't exist. And there's this really cool analogy about defensive driving. And it's sort of the idea that everyone but you is a really terrible driver and breaks the laws, doesn't do a full stop at a stop sign, you know, talks on their cell phone, text. So you have to drive defensively in response to that. And so there's this idea of like defensive software writing, defensive like coding. And so it's sort of the idea that you shouldn't trust anyone, like not even yourself. And you should code defensively against like your mistakes and the mistakes of other people, which I thought was kind of interesting. I think it's basically just know that you can't write perfect software and, I don't know, follow best practices.
Yeah. To me, the quote that really encapsulates it from this tip is, quote, pragmatic programmers code in defense of their own mistakes, unquote. Mm-hmm. And to me, this just means A, testing is one of the base principles. And B, like I've talked about before, this hard lesson I keep learning over and over is never assuming that the user is wrong.
Right.
Assume that it's either a design or a code flaw, or you're not validating inputs correctly. Like there's something that you're doing wrong that's leading to the unexpected behavior. So know that you can't write perfect software. With that in mind, the next tip, tip 31, is design with contracts. And this is a pretty meaty section. And I think, JP, you've got some great notes here that you're going to walk us through. But this is actually kind of like a more fundamental software principle, like a computer science principle of this idea of designing with contracts in place, which is kind of this idea of asserting something to be true. Walk us through this a little bit, JP.
Yeah, so the idea of designing by contract is actually something that should be built into the language. And I don't think Java or C or C++ have this built in. So there was a code snippet of a language that had it built in. And I forgot what that language was. It was some weird thing. But the idea is basically when you write a contract, the contract specifies preconditions and postconditions. So what needs to happen for this code to run and what is expected of this code after it runs. And so I was like, that's kind of weird. I don't really understand what this is. So I obviously the first thing I did was Google design by contracts Ruby. and so I found this library, obviously, that someone had implemented this idea of designing by contracts when you write Ruby code. And what really made me understand it a little bit more is he said, you can think of contracts as assert on steroids. So what you're basically doing is asserting something, you know, maybe it's before the method, and you assert like the precondition and the postcondition, and if that contract is fulfilled, then your code runs. And so it's kind of this idea of testing inside of your code. I don't know, it's kind of a weird thing, but one thing that stood out to me, it was the author posed this question of like, what is a correct program? And then he answers by saying, or they answer by saying, a correct program is one that does no more and no less than it claims to do. And you document it by verifying that claim. And that's basically, that's what the heart of designing by contract is.
Makes a lot of sense. It reminds me a little bit of the type-safe languages that I've like checked out and explored a little bit. Just the idea, because you wrote down this idea of, at least in this Ruby, there's a code example in the notes of, you know, require contracts, and then there's this concept of double, and the contract is saying there'll be a number in and a number out. Uh-huh. And then you tried to, in the example, double just a string, and that's not going to work. That's going to break that contract. It won't double the number because it's not a number input and not a number output. Uh-huh. And so the idea here is that the correct type is coming in and the correct type is coming out. Now, I think that there's more that you could do to ensure that the contract is valid. And I know that there's more assertions you could make about the inputs and outputs. And so it's more than just type safety, but it's a really interesting idea. I feel like in some ways it's more than I need in a lot of the code I write. A, because I don't write life or death code for the most part. So the idea that, you know, a method failing isn't going to kill someone, isn't going to create some type of error that's incorrectable. Like, there's no way that we can possibly fix this. And outside of that, like, I feel like some of the other exception handling that's already in place, at least in my world of just web programming, is sufficient enough to manage some of these exceptions and find them and report them. But I do love the idea that less test coverage is needed. Like, if you had contracts like this on most of your methods, there's not really a lot of reason to unit test these methods potentially.
Yeah, exactly. That's sort of the idea, is it's like assert on steroids, right? And so the big question is why can't I just test? And so I think the argument that the authors are providing is that designing by contracts spans beyond like inheritance. Like, you can't like inherit your test. Your tests don't, where's my note? I'm probably not articulating this as well as I should be. Oh, okay, here it is. The reason that this is, you know, supposedly more powerful than assertions is that contracts can propagate down the inheritance hierarchy, whereas tests don't. And I sort of agree with you that this is probably much more than I need. I think I can cover most of my bases with testing. And in fact, I probably like the redundancy of having to test multiple things down the,
exactly,
the inheritance hierarchy. And especially because it's not like built into Ruby or JavaScript. So I feel like bringing in something that's, I don't know, like, I don't think that this solution was built into the Ruby language. And so any sort of off-the-shelf solution that someone might provide just seems like a little hacky.
Yeah, I would agree with you, especially like pulling in this whole gem just to manage contracts. But I think this principle could hold up a little bit if you like thought about something like a guard clause, an early return, you know, so that's like, if the input is not an integer, then return early in this function. And I think, or in this method more accurately. And I think that something like that, which in principle, in some ways is kind of inheriting this contract idea that we're going to make sure we have the correct inputs and outputs. I like that idea. And I think that I should be doing that more and making each individual method all the way down to the method level less error prone, and not just depend on, you know, what's coming in that endpoint to validate it. Also think through what could possibly in theory hit this method and try to think about how to prevent that and make sure the inputs coming out are positive integers. You know, that's a perfect example. Just the other day I was implementing this promo code systems, and promo code systems are like notoriously difficult, but the system would generate negative amounts for a discount. So for example, if you had a tutoring session, this is for WizTutor tutoring we've talked about before. If you had a tutoring session that only cost you, was going to cost you $20, and you had a $30 promo code, it would actually throw a negative 30. And so in my method, I wasn't guarding against the idea of a, you know, if it's less than zero, just return zero, that they shouldn't be getting a credit. They should only be getting zero. Luckily, I caught this before we like flipped the switch live, but it would have been really easy to get through. And if I would have thought of this method from the idea of a contract, like what should go in and what should go out, I would have realized that a non-zero integer should never leave this.
Yeah, I'm just so set in my ways. I'm feeling that resistance of, this is a new idea, I don't like it. And I'm just like, I would test everything. I would try to come up with all the edge cases and just test it. But yeah,
because you could, in theory, test for a non-zero output. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea that you're actually, you know, even if you're testing for it, you're thinking about it and writing the method and thinking about this idea of contracts, even if you don't implement this exact pattern. That's kind of what I'm saying here. That's my takeaway from this.
Yeah, totally. I think it's a cool, I don't want to say thought experiment, but I think it's a good way to be thinking about your code if if you have this, maybe you don't actually write the contract, but you are actively aware of what the contract should be, is
right.
Probably even a good way to code itself.
Yeah, even thinking about testing, of like thinking about it, am I going to be satisfying all the inputs and outputs? It's just a good way to think about testing in general. And I don't necessarily think about it that way. I just think, what's the golden path? Write the test for that, build against it. And I might think about like one false scenario or one alternate path or two. I don't think about all the different inputs and outputs that could be there and all those edge cases. And so it's a good way to think about that.
Yeah, and sometimes testing all of the edge cases can be quite the hassle. So I wonder how that would translate into contracts, because sometimes you might have a method that has, it might have many different branches that it could go into. And so, you know, let's say you even have just like two or three like if statements, like how do you have a contract? Anyways, we're getting a little bit
into it.
I
think that that's a code smell. I think that the idea is that you're pushing towards simpler methods that do have one input and one output. And if you can't think of a contract for your method, probably think about breaking it up.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of just like how testing shouldn't be painful.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about tip number 32, which is crash early. And it's, you know, basically when you're really tired at night, just go to sleep. No, I'm kidding. Although I'm sure that's somewhere. So crash early is another defensive programming technique. And what the authors are saying is not to have this mentality of, hey, that can't happen. And so to be aware of all of the ways that your program can fail. What I took away from this tip is also to just make sure that you account for all of the different types of errors and handle those errors correctly. Because it's so easy to, especially if you're like writing a Redux application, and let's say you handle all of your action creators are all doing all of your API requests. It's so easy to just like assume that the API requests sent back like a 200 or a 201. Oftentimes, it's so easy to not account for having a bad internet connection, or maybe the API failed, or for whatever reason, like it timed out, and so you didn't get the 200 okay. And how do you handle those in your UI, or how do you handle like that error state? Sometimes you just don't do anything, and you just console log it out, and it's like, oh great. So like, how do I know that the API request wasn't successful? Just open up your dev tools, and you'll see a nice little console log that says API request failed, which I have never done. No, I have done that way too many times than I would like to admit. But the idea of crashing early is, I think it's summed up nicely through this quote, and it's, a dead program normally does a lot less damage than a crippled one. So the idea of crashing early is that, like, make your program fail and have it just die instead of like carrying on like dead weight. Because if you don't like crash early, and like, you know, you might have like, let's say you're making an API request to Google Maps, and you know that data doesn't get, your like map data, your geo-coordinates or whatever it is, doesn't get properly sent back. Now all of a sudden you have bad data that you keep passing along, and you keep passing it along, and by the time you actually need to use that data, it's like, oh, it's not correct.
In a lot of ways, this reminds me of, I read this book called The Toyota Way, which is all about manufacturing and how Toyota produces their vehicles. And they have this thing on, so if you picture a car, you know, it moves from the chassis to adding the wheels to adding the seats in it, and they keep building the car down the production line. And Toyota has this concept of the Andon cord, and it runs the entire length of the production line. And they did this like at the height of their engineering and the height of their ingenuity and innovation. And basically, what would happen is, if there was any problem with the vehicle, like if a nut wouldn't fit into a bolt, or if you couldn't get a door on straight and it didn't fit right, so there was a problem with that door supplier or the person making the doors down the line, they would pull this cord and the entire production line would stop. The entire line would stop, because otherwise what ends up happening is you have this faulty door go down the line, and then it leads to other problems and other problems and other problems down the line. Like, problems continue to build and get worse. And so this idea of, you know, a crippled program creating more problems than it's worth, I couldn't agree with more. And so the idea of like crashing early to me is kind of this Andon cord metaphor, which is this idea that like you stop everything, and at least you know that you can fix the root problem. So you go to that door supplier and you refactor the door, bring it back, and now you can gracefully keep moving down the line. I do think it's important, this UX, you put a note here about UX, like what happens, what do users see when there's an error? And I would err on the side of like, I would rather have like a server 500 error page with like contact administrator, something went wrong, than to be doing something that the user's not understanding. So like I used to use rescue really aggressively in my Ruby code instead of like thinking through all the different scenarios of what could fail and how to handle it. And so oftentimes like a user would go to send a text and like it wouldn't fall down and it wouldn't fail, wouldn't do anything because I had rescue in place just to like keep everything running. Cause I was so afraid of users seeing these error pages. I was so afraid a user would see something went wrong type of a message or any type of a fall down that I would err on the side of just, you know, kind of ignoring it and having it move forward. But the problem is like, well, that text didn't send. And ultimately that's worse for a user, assuming that an action happened, assuming that their card was charged, assuming that their order went through, but nothing actually happened. So of course, ideally you want elegant and great error message that handle it. But I think it's better that you are aware of a hard fail. It shows up in your logs. You know, I've got Rollbar set up. I get an email every time those come in. And to me, I would rather have an inbox of 35 hard 500 errors the next morning than to not be 100% sure that my application is running well. And so to me, allowing that to happen is that and on cord. Now, my applications do show a nice error, you know, a little red banner, something went wrong, contact administrator, that and guides users a little bit more than just a hard fail page. Even still, I think it's really important to allow your application to crash. Don't lean on things like rescue too aggressively unless you're handling those exceptions and surfacing them up. It's better for it to crash, you to log those and track those, than to have a crippled application continue to move along.
Yeah, and I think that metaphor of a car on an assembly line is a perfect metaphor, probably much better than I was able to articulate. Just thinking about if one nut or bolt doesn't screw on properly and you just ignore that, you know, that could lead to crazy errors, and you might not even know where it originated from unless you stop right then and there and say, okay, we need to fix this.
Right, because like down the line, they're trying to put, you know, a seat in or the steering wheel on. It's like, oh, they have to kind of force it in, and then they make that happen. And then that car ships and kills someone because it falls apart on the road because that bolt didn't fit. And so, and you're totally right about like not knowing where the source is, which I'll talk about later. So the next tip, tip 33, if it can't happen, use assertions to ensure that it won't happen. So let's not practice the self-deception when coding. So it's like, In the book, there's this example of, well, this application will never be used internationally, so why internationalize it? You know, it's only for the US only. And this idea of being overconfident in our assumptions, you know, we need to, like we opened this podcast with, we need to be sure that we're willing to challenge our assumptions and write code against it and see if it can or can't happen, like in the code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And this goes back to some of the previous tips that we've talked about and discussed at length about checking your ego at the door and, oh, I've written this code 100 million times. I've written CRUD controllers and all it does is return, you know, an index or a show or a new or a form or whatever. And you just think like, well, I've done that 100 times. Why do I need to test it? Well, just like prove it then. That's sort of where it is.
Yeah. It's, and some of this stuff too, like you assume certain things are going to be there. So, you know, a good example is I work on this WizTutor application and there was this idea of this slight slush fund of the Stripe account where, you know, a student books a session with a tutor and it's charged and then the slush account pays out the tutor. And I always assumed that there would be money in the Stripe account, not thinking through like how that would exactly affect our application. And there's been a couple times when that slush account and the Stripe account was very close to zero or zero just because of the way that we were running with promo codes and hey, startup. And, you know, that created some terrible errors for users. For example, cards being charged, but things not being paid out because of the holding times. And it was something that I didn't assume would ever happen. And it was an edge case that I probably should have tested for and thought about and written tests against. Yeah. So think about how the world's going to screw things up for you and try to write tests against it.
In fact, I think that this is some of the most low-hanging fruit, because oftentimes I think these things that you assume to be true and so you don't test, these are the easiest things to test, in fact, because it's like, okay, I just wrote an index controller that's going to show me a list of users. And so like, why do I ever need to test that? Well, like, dude, that's probably like the easiest test you're ever going to write. You're not testing any crazy business logic. The method only returns an array of users. Like the assertions for that are crazy simple, and it gives you a little bit of peace of mind writing a simple test and just seeing it pass. And I think that's good because oftentimes it's hard to write tests in general. I don't know why there's this resistance, but it's sort of like, I like to think of it as like a basketball player who hasn't, you know, made a ton of shots. Like if you're a shooter, for example, but like all you need to do is like, you need to see like a couple shots fall and all of a sudden like you get that confidence back, right? And so I think the same thing can apply to testing. Like you see a couple tests pass, you write a couple more tests, all of a sudden your test coverage like increments a couple percent. And it's like, you know what? You know, this isn't so bad. Like maybe I should strive to hit that, whatever that sweet spot is, 60, 70% test coverage.
80, 90, come on.
80, 90% test coverage.
Yeah, and I think it's about like just exercising that muscle and having that be part of the daily practice mm-hmm. of writing code is that it has good test coverage against it.
Yeah, totally. Because it's just so easy to not write tests, but you're right. It's like a muscle. You know, you have to exercise it to get it to make it stronger.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about tip number 34: use exceptions for exceptional problems. And so this is we touched on this just a second ago about, you know, relying on rescue, or if you're in JavaScript land, try catch. And so one of the questions that the authors pose is, ask yourself this: if will this code still run if I remove all these exception handlers? And if the answer is no, then maybe you're using exceptions in non-exceptional circumstances. And so this one was a little interesting to me. I didn't quite vibe with it, but I mean, it's funny because one of the patterns to use in JavaScript when you're writing like a Redux application, if you don't want to use a bunch of promises and you want to leverage the features of, I think it's like ES6, whatever, like async await, ES7 now. I don't know. There's so many different specs of JavaScript. There's so many specifications. But anyways, one pattern to use if you don't want to use promises is to use a try catch. And if like an API request fails, whatever asynchronous action it is that you're doing, you catch, then you do something, you know, whether it's display different UI. But so to me, I was like, oh crap, I use this a lot because it's actually like a pattern that's pretty typical in Redux applications.
But in that example, isn't that an exception that you're handling? Because they're not saying exceptional like good or large. They're saying exceptional like it's an exception to something you assumed would happen. So in my mind, when you're using it in JavaScript in this way, it's pull down this index of items on this endpoint. And if that doesn't happen, catch it and do this. So in my mind, that is exactly how you're supposed to be using it.
Okay, so that's what I was like, what am I doing wrong here?
No, you're doing it correctly. So that's what they're saying. So for me, when I was a junior dev 3 or 4 years ago, I would use things like rescue instead of validations on input.
So there was an error
on the incoming and it couldn't process, like let's say first name nil, so it couldn't send an email, I would use rescue to handle that exception. So that's an example of not using an exception for an exceptional problem. And I think that this happens, especially in other frameworks, people either they're novice or they're not disciplined in how they use things, and they will handle errors as if they were exceptions. And so I think very, very loosely, and I don't have a technical knowledge of this, but in my mind now, being a little bit more of an experienced developer, very loosely, an error is based on incorrect inputs, and exceptions is an error in a process. Like it's attempting to do something and it doesn't go as planned. That's very a loose definition there, but in my mind, it's using exception handling, which is I have an expectation that something's going to happen, and then it doesn't happen. You're using that for error handling, and that is a really bad practice. And so they're saying, make sure that you're disciplined in using exception handling four times that you're expecting something back, and that thing didn't operate the way you expected, and that you're using that in a way that's beneficial to your user or to your application. A perfect example is like, charge this credit card. It's a perfect example for a rescue. Having that rescue push back to your application and handle that failed card, not just move over it like nothing happened, but you know, return back to the user an example of whatever Stripe is giving you back. So invalid date, or you know, not enough money in the account, or card declined, those types of messages you're displaying back to the user. That's exactly what they're talking about. And your example of try catch is hopefully that way, like this expectational error handling.
Exactly, yeah. And I was like, well, if I remove all these try catches, my program definitely would break. So I guess the question is if like the way you're using exceptions, like could that just be replaced with an if else? And if it can be, then maybe you're using it incorrectly. That's sort of how I'm thinking about it.
That could be a better way to handle it. Yeah. Yeah, I was a little confused about the idea of removing it and it could still run, because I was like, well, if the exception occurs, it won't still run.
Yeah,
so that's I think what they're saying here is like, if your code runs without any exceptions failing, like your expectations coming back is true, then it should run without any issue.
I think.
Which is like, well, yeah, that's kind of office. But I think it's a good tip. And if you are doing something in this, which is like handling errors with exception handling, then, you know, there's probably other ways to approach this in the way that you're designing your application. Mm-hmm. So the last tip, which is very apropos. Is that how you say that? Apropos?
I think so, yeah.
Apropos. Okay. Is just because our last tip is finish what you start. So our tip here is finishing what we started as far as the list of tips that we're going through. You know, this gets into a little bit of technical ideas of threads, transactions, and garbage collection, which I think JP is going to touch on a little bit. But luckily, and this, I feel like this tip ages the book a little bit in that most modern languages and frameworks handle garbage collection for us. So we're like, we're pretty lucky in that we don't have to handle all these things specifically. Mm-hmm. But I will say the idea of finish what you start from a method and a technical approach is really important and something that I'm kind of learning the hard way lately. A good example is like I have WebSocket connections I open up on some of my applications and I'm not very disciplined about how I close those. So like I open up these connections, but I don't close them in disciplined ways. So like my timeouts, I think the default is like 4 hours or 12 hours. And so I have a lot of these Action Cable connections opening up on a Redis server and I'm paying for each active endpoint and yet I'm not closing them with discipline. And so that's bringing up server costs and bringing down performance. So to me, when I read finish what you start from a technical perspective, it's if you open up a WebSocket, have a way to close that and check if it's still active. Another example for me is like I have methods that send emails and oftentimes I am not checking whether or not those delivered or whether there was errors with that delivery, which is kind of difficult to do. But in some ways from a technical approach, I'm not closing that loop and like rechecking with the email API of whether or not that message was delivered and handling that back to the end user. Because ultimately my user is coming to my application to serve a feature. They're requesting something to happen. And in some ways, if I'm not handling that undelivered email, I'm not finishing that request in a way that's elegant, in a way that's solid from a design standpoint. So that's kind of what I got out of this tip.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So the example of closing your connection in Action Cable is exactly what this tip is about. And so like, let's say you didn't do that. And let's say Rails didn't have some built-in mechanism to automatically close that connection. Then you would just have this long-running process that is eating up your memory. So an example in JavaScript land is like, let's say for whatever reason you write a set interval. And so you just have the set interval run every, I don't know, 2 seconds or so. And if you don't close that interval when your component unmounts or when someone navigates away from the page, you just have this interval running forever. Or I don't know, you know? And so finish what you start isn't necessarily about literally finishing what you start. It's literally just doing your due diligence and garbage collecting.
Yeah,
so yeah, luckily a lot of the frameworks do that for us.
Yeah, I remember another application like back in the day I was doing file upload in a really, really strange way. And I was creating all these temp files like mm-hmm. in the intermediary and I wasn't cleaning them out. And I ended up with gigabytes of these temp files. This is like way before I understood how things like this were supposed to work. Because I was just like shoving them onto Heroku and paying these Heroku storage. It was like, it wasn't gigabytes, it was megabytes though, hundreds of megabytes. And I was like, why is this crashing? Why is this happening? So I was doing this completely wrong. I hacked a lot of shit together when I was first writing code.
That's funny. Yeah, I think when I was first hacking on this like WebRTC thing, because WebRTC is all about two peers communicating, mm-hmm. and it's so easy to forget to like close connections off, or like when someone disconnects, when one peer leaves, to like close out that connection. And so, I don't know, this is like one of those things that it's just easy to neglect because it's like, well, fuck it.
Cool. Those are some great tips for this week. And so essentially the whole idea overall is being a little bit paranoid. So to just recap the tips real quick, tip 30, you can't write perfect software. 31, design with contracts. 32, crash early. 33, if it can't happen, use assertions to ensure that it won't happen. 34, use exceptions for exceptional problems. 35, finish what you start. You want to jump into picks?
Yes. So my pick for this week is this application called Dash. D-A-S-H, and what it is it lets you download documentation for your favorite language or framework, and have it on your computer for offline use. And it's really freaking cool. And it's actually free, but it's like one of those Sublime things where if you want to pay $30 to support the devs, you can. And I highly recommend that you do. I'm just still, you know, testing out the water, seeing if I like it. But it's really cool. You can, I have like Elixir docs, I have Ruby docs. You can even download like Gem documentation, GitHub documentation. Pretty cool.
That's sweet. I feel like I've seen something like this, but this isn't the one. This looks a little bit better designed than the one I have used in the past. It's cool that you can just download offline too. That's really cool. Because I feel like half the time that I need internet for like doing my job, because like I work remote a lot and on trains and things like that. But half the time is like just like being in the Ruby docs or being in certain Gem docs, just to like make sure I'm doing things right. So I like this idea that I could work more flexibly offline. This is super cool. Good pick.
What's yours?
This week, so I'm super excited. I was at RailsConf this year and all the RailsConf talks are live. And I will link in the show notes a quick blog post of kind of my top picks, but I will call out one specifically. There's lots of amazing talks and I linked all of them, but then I also linked a blog post of kind of my favorites. There's so many good talks. So if you are a Rails developer, there's some really great talks, but there's also ones, even if you're not a Rails developer, there's some more general talks that are really good just about design and lots of great talks. So I would encourage you to check it out. But one I will call out specifically, especially if you're on Rails, is Candy on Rails Polymorphism in Rails 5 by Michael Caine. Michael Caine, which is not that Michael Caine. But it's, I saw this talk there live in person. And the next day it changed the way I was writing code and I've refactored a lot using polymorphism in Rails 5 and I'm leaning on it really hard and it's such an elegant way to handle a lot of things. You know, just a quick example is like having something like comments or notes on things. So you can have a single notes object that's shared between a bunch of different parent level models. And it's just such a clean way to handle it with a single controller. And it's totally changed my approach. And it's something I should have learned a long time ago. But using it to its full ability has been amazing in the past month or so since I've been back from RailsConf. And it's a great talk and I would strongly recommend it.
Dang, I'm super excited. I got to see that.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you guys so much for listening. And do you have a little outro, little snippet about supporting us that you want to mention?
I guess this week I'll say if you want to support us, just take a deep breath and stay alive. Be safe out there so you can continue listening. We love all you guys.
All right.
We'll talk to you next week. All right. Later, everybody.
See you guys.